Is there room for a nap in this?
Hey, everybody. We've got a special episode for you today. Three of our coworkers are taking over, and they're going to chat all things beer. So be gentle and welcome John, Peter, and Jay.
Welcome to Death by Millennial, Bad Dad's Takeover Edition. Let's get ready to rumble! You probably figured out we're not Tiffany or Dana, but we're their friends and colleagues, Jay, myself, Peter, and John. And we're taking a closer look at the industries millennials are supposedly killing. And today we're killing something very dear to my heart, killing beer.
All right, so I thought we'd introduce ourselves, a bit about ourselves, so I could go first. I'm John, and I am a designer here at Hornell Anderson. And I am a Gen Xer, as Jay had alluded to. And my favorite beer is the IPA, I have to say. I'm a true West Coaster in terms of that. The hoppier, the better. You know, give me a double IPA, give me a triple IPA. I'm all for it. And the definition of a bad dad, in my definition, it's kind of like you're a little rough around the edges. You maybe have a few too many beers after mowing the lawn, yell at the kids a little bit. But, you know, by the end of the day, you're wrestling on the ground with them again. And, you know, you're the good dad again. So it's a complex kind of thing.
Yeah, I kind of think of a bad dad as a dad that never lost that little bit of bro in him, you know, that we all started. So, like, maybe cool dad's better. You know, we didn't give in to dadhood and buy Dockers and do all the things that a air quote good dad's supposed to do. I'm Jay, and I'm a design director, and I'm also a Gen Xer. My favorite genre of beer now has to be IPA, which is surprising because a couple of years ago, if you'd asked me, I would have never said that. But I think my beer tastes have evolved.
And lastly, this is Peter Anderson. I'm a creative director, a bad dad, Gen X. I love the IPA as well. My bad dad definition would be that I'm proud of my dad bod, and I'm okay with a little too much beer on the weekend. Mowing the lawn, nothing gives me better satisfaction than to tell my kids to go out and weed while I sip on my favorite IPA.
Oh, nice.
Well said. So some bigger questions we plan to address today. We'll give you a quick history of beer in the U.S.
We're going to look at current affairs. Is big beer dying? Is craft faltering? What should beer in general be worried about?
We're going to look at some game changers. What's trendy or superficial, and what's here to stay? What are truly innovative things right now? And for all of the above, are millennials really to blame for killing big beer?
So we could do a quick history about beer in general and the history of beer back to Egypt or Mesopotamia, but we're just going to keep it to beer in the U.S. today to keep it simple. And even that isn't that simple. So the belief of temperance or drinking little or no alcohol came to a flashpoint in the 1800s when groups like the Women's Christian Temperance Movement championed the universal prohibition of alcohol. They did so because they believed the saloon was the center of society's problems and campaigned for prohibition using a mixture of prayer and direct confrontational action.
Well, what a buzzkill that would be to be sitting in the saloon and have the Women's Christian Temperance Movement come in and confront you about your beer consumption.
Sounds kind of scary. See here, Carrie Nation was this woman who carried around an axe.
Mm-hmm, carrying around an axe. Yeah, before Lizzie Borden, there was Carrie Nation, and she was an imposing figure. So 6 feet tall, dressed in black, and accessorized with an axe. And this is from beerandbrewing.com. In 1890, Kansas was a dry state, but the law was not being enforced. So, with a group of her sisters, Carrie Nation prayed and read the Bible outside a saloon in the town of Medicine Lodge, hoping God would force it to close. So that didn't work. And eventually, she grew tired of waiting and strode into the saloon with her axe and smashed the place to matchwood, while patrons fled and staff stood agape. Between 1900 and 1910, she was arrested 30 times for violent conduct and criminal damage. She paid her fines and fees from lecture tours and sales of souvenir axes. Got to talk about knowing your brand right there.
I wonder how much one of those would be valued at on like Antiques Roadshow right now.
An official Carrie Nation axe.
$1 million.
Interesting. In her own words, she was a bulldog running at the feet of Jesus, barking at what he doesn't like.
The temperance movement eventually put enough social pressure on local and federal government that nationwide prohibition of alcohol took effect from 1920 to 1933, which of course disrupted beer in a big way. Before prohibition, there were something like 1,300 active breweries in the U.S., and afterward, only about 100 or so of those were able to survive and start back up after prohibition. That number's ebbed and flowed in the coming decades, and at the end of the 1970s, the number was still around 100.
So not much choice or variation out there. Of the 100 that were still brewing through the 40s, 50s, and 60s, I can guarantee you that most of them were brewing something akin to Bud or Bud Light. Light American Pilsner.
So even World War II contributed to that. The soldiers were drinking rations of light and low alcohol beer, probably to keep them sort of happy.
Orderly.
Yeah.
Just enough.
Happy, but not too happy.
That's 16 million Americans that served in World War II. 10% of the population. So that's a lot of people drinking Bud Light, basically. That just further solidified the generation's comfort level with watered-down beer.
So one general observation that could be made was that coming out of Prohibition, Americans' taste buds, particularly the younger generation, had been reset by 14 years of basically soft drinks and the temperance movement before it, and needed to ease back into more robust beers. So it was a long time before people got accustomed to anything besides bland light beer. And I thought it was just Prohibition that changed the palate, but I think it was all the years leading up to Prohibition. I think there was a lot of ingrained guilt, it sounds like, in the country. And people, if they were drinking beer, it wasn't as openly. And the beer that was available leading up to Prohibition was probably on the blander side, too. The lighter, the better.
Then finally, Jimmy Carter signs a bill in 1978 legalizing home brewing. I didn't realize, but that's not that long ago, really.
That wasn't that long ago.
I was just 2 years old.
Yeah.
I could have been a brewer.
I was six.
I was similar age range as well, Gen X, fellow Gen Xers. My dad actually started home brewing maybe a year or two after that. And I don't know if that was he would have anyway, or if, you know, there was a national awareness about that, but a lot of people started brewing right when that law changed. And, you know, within 20 years of that, a generation, we had several of the kind of fundamental fundamental craft breweries established in the country.
Does your dad ever talk about how he got into it?
No, you know, he's kind of a hobbyist, a DIY guy. So, you know, he would do things like make swords or knives himself, or, you know, he was into rocketry back in the 60s. And so I think this was just another geeky thing for him to do. That's good on him.
Thanks, Jimmy Carter.
Yeah. So definitely from going from homogenous beers for the decades before, you know, slowly but surely people's palates are being introduced to hoppy, malty beers once again.
And within 10 years of that bill being signed, craft brewing was only 0.1% of total beer sales, which is today it's 20% of a $100 billion plus market. and from 100 breweries to about 7,000.
So it's come a long way. So today we're going to sample the spectrum of everything from beer to seltzer, hard seltzer to cider, everything that people are excited today about outside of traditional beer and craft beer. And we'll give our dad ratings. I want to try this hop water because it looks absolutely disgusting.
So this is a Lagunitas hop refresher. Zero alcohol.
It looks like Sprite.
There's a slight green tinge to it, I mm-hmm. guess just to like let you know, reassure you that it is made from hops.
It smells like beer.
It tastes like LaCroix.
It does.
I love LaCroix.
It's like a hop LaCroix.
I could find better alternatives.
If I want a beer, I want a beer.
Shall we go on to another one?
What's this one?
This is Seek Out Hard Seltzer, which is a brand that's new to me.
All 5% right. alcohol.
What's the flavor of this one?
I would guess by the design. Oh, key lime and mint.
Key lime and mint. Okay.
See, this is dangerous because I can't even distinguish any alcohol in here at all.
Yeah, this...
Not a bit.
Not so keen on the taste. Like, I don't know if I get a strong cucumber. I'm not sure what I'm getting from that. You guys?
I'm getting a lot of sugar.
So this could...
Really?
This could definitely go after the millennial or other consumer who, you know, is interested in a lower calorie, non-beer, and something that's a little lighter that doesn't mm-hmm. bog them down too much. I could see the appeal.
I could see this is would be something maybe on a hot summer afternoon where you just need something refreshing.
Yeah, there's just not a whole lot of personality. Though.
All right, next up, kombucha, hard kombucha, royal ginger flavor.
I'd never seen a kombucha before. Yeah. It's organic, so that's good.
At least now kombucha is owning alcohol because it always has been a little fermented.
Yeah, right.
Right? Mm-hmm.
But just a couple percent, like a percent and a half.
Enough to get Lindsay Lohan in trouble when she was...
That's right.
Supposed to not be drinking.
Her relapse was because of GT's kombucha.
I love the aroma. It's like a ginger snap. So it tastes authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And some kombuchas I've had are pretty sour, and I can't get over it. But this is pretty smooth.
It's smooth, yeah. I could drink this in an afternoon. Wouldn't be my first choice. Yeah. But what do you want to do next?
We'll go to...
See, one of those tall boys.
A seltzer. This is a... Soundcraft Seltzer Company Rosé Seltzer.
Rosé, that's the big hit item now in the craft beer aisle, I think.
Millennials may be killing beer, but they are definitely bringing rosé back in a big way.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's pink in color, which I guess makes sense for a rosé.
Peter, I see the skeptical small pour there.
Like I said, I like IPAs.
It's winey. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, I guess this is what my friends who put ice cubes in their wine to kind of slow down their consumption mm-hmm. would maybe like.
my dad would be really into it.
Yes.
It's really watered down.
Yeah. All right, next. Now we're getting into a real beer. So Rosalie, beer brewed with hibiscus and wine grapes. This is rosé beer.
It's a dead match to the color they picked for the can. So good color matching.
Good job, guys.
Yeah. Good job, design team. And this is another one where I'm not getting the rosé.
Bummer.
It tastes like a light beer.
Something is missing here. I feel like we took several steps back to the hop water. What about the Sufferfest? It's still 5% or something, right?
Yeah. It's 5.5, pale ale brewed with salt and black currant. So this was inspired by athletes.
This is definitely one of the products that we've seen where you go to the website and it's highly designed and targeted to, mm-hmm. you can see younger consumers, active consumers.
This is like the Gatorade of beers. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's that's what I understand. It's going to replenish your electrolytes, and I don't know, you'll probably be a better person after drinking this.
It's that permission again to enjoy beer, like the casually crushable BFD. The Miller is, I feel like, pushing.
Or, yeah, like Michelob Ultra.
Run a marathon, treat yourself. I feel better already.
It's not bad, actually.
It's good. I like the name, Sufferfest. I could get behind that.
I'm not suffering at all right now. We're getting a lot of looks.
We're working, people. Can't you see this?
Mm-hmm.
This is a session.
We've got a New Belgium Watermelon Lime Hibiscus and Agave Fresca, Agua Fresca Cerveza. So is it like a craft take on like a, you know, one of the lime beers?
In some ways, before I tasted, this seems like the sweet spot of millennial collaborations. You've got your exotic fruits.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sweeteners. You're not even quite sure what format you're drinking.
It smells just like a light beer. Like the fruit overwhelms the beer. It smells like beer, but it tastes like fruit.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be a tough sell anywhere other than like a hot summer day at the beach.
Yeah. It's when they get too many fruits in there, it feels muddy to me.
I can think of better ways to consume 110 calories.
Well, the funny thing to me is we're talking about the death of big beer because millennials are drinking a lot of these other things that we've just tasted, which seem much closer to big beer to me than your craft beers.
Right.
What would you describe as big beer?
Well, when we say big beer, maybe we should be saying big brands. So, mm-hmm. Your Budweisers, your Coors, your, you know,
light
domestic lagers.
Yeah.
Homogeneous.
Yeah. The beers that I remember my dad drinking when I was a kid, and mm-hmm. they were having a block party and he was drinking Pabst Blue Ribbon or Miller Lite.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about sessionable, but really those were the original sessionable beers.
Yeah.
Were those light lagers.
Mm-hmm.
They still are. People drink them so that they can drink a lot of them and not be filled
day.
Up. Not be filled up.
Yeah, and day drinking.
And, you know, some of these drinks we've just tasted are in that same spirit, but just with a much more adventurous palate in mind.
Yeah, would your dad buy a Bud Light with hibiscus in it?
He wouldn't be caught dead.
I don't think so.
Yeah, right. That's interesting to ponder that a big brand like Bud Light is being rejected, but yet something that's equally as light, maybe a little more adventurous, but, you know, pretty much in the same vein of sessionability, drinkability, you know, light and refreshing without filling you up. They're really, both of them are checking all those boxes.
Yeah, these are much more accessible. I mean, even the designs are more cheerful and I would say appealing to both genders, you know, just not as dense from a design standpoint or a naming standpoint as a lot of those IPAs, double IPAs that are out there. It's just not as intimidating of a way in.
They're cheerful. They're not gonna kill you like Kilt Lifter or something like that.
right.
They are gonna be fun.
Do you think these are the new fruity malt liquors of when we were kids? Not kids. Do you think these are the new
Mad Dog,
like the Bartles and James wine cooler kind of thing?
I feel like these are the new generation of those where you haven't quite cut your teeth into drinking stronger beers, but you're curious.
A gateway drink.
There's many gateways now.
Yeah, well, but when I think back to my younger days, you know, if you had given me a hoppy bodied IPA, I'd probably spit it out because I just didn't have a palate for it at the time.
Yeah.
I remember first drinking beer and, you know, you're like, cringe as you sip it because it's so sharp.
Yep.
And like IPAs do that for me now, like because I want that. I want that kind of like strength in a sip. And this new frou-frou stuff is not doing it.
We want our beers to make us feel alive.
Like kids again.
Not that we drank when we were, we were 21.
I was an angel.
Right? Of course.
So now let's talk about what's going on in beer today.
Is big beer losing ground to craft? It might be the other way around. Retail dollars of craft increased 7% in 2018, up to $27.6 billion, and now account for more than 24% of the $114 billion U.S. beer market. However, big brewers are snapping up independent craft brewers at a breakneck pace.
In 2015, Ballast Point Brewery was purchased by AB InBev for upwards of $1 billion. So that just goes to show how valuable these smaller breweries appear to these brewing giants.
You're a 10 Barrels fan, right?
I am.
I was on Instagram yesterday, and 10 Barrels has just released a snowboard video called Hold My Beer. And I don't know, would they have been able to do a snowboard video without having the backing of a big beer brand?
Maybe not, because you figure
that's a lot of dollars.
Yeah, I'm sure their marketing budget may not support the creation of snowboard videos.
The positives and negatives.
I'm sure it supports their values, and maybe they could have done some little gonzo thing by themselves, but
like a friend of a friend.
Yeah, they probably have higher production values and reach a bigger audience this way.
Yep.
Right.
And now you can get it on an airplane. Like that's the benefit. Make a snowboard video, get it on an airplane, sell out.
So I think in a way people are going to have to change how they're thinking about craft breweries.
Well, and we know some drinkers will, at least early on, craft diehards and enthusiasts would reject craft brewers for getting too big. Like forget about being bought by Miller Coors or AB. Just if they got too big and had too much distribution, I guess they felt like they lost their connection to the brand,
the sense of being local and down grassroots.
Right.
It's more like the Roman Empire model now, where they come in, they conquer, but they let each little town or village or principality kind of keep their own customs and keep things running the same. When in the same way, everybody knows who's in charge.
It's like when I'm at the store making a choice, the 10 Barrels is a good looking beer. And I don't think they've really ruined that brand.
No, they're smart enough to know, just let them do their thing without interfering too much.
It's probably, we work in packaging a lot and we work with big food, and there's lots of case studies inside big food that suggest it's best to leave brands alone. And I suspect AB and Miller are all doing the right thing with craft right now.
I think Gen Xers are unique in that we were of beer drinking age when kind of the rise of the craft breweries. So when I was, of beer drinking age, craft really hadn't taken a big foothold. Like we said, it was like 0.1% of the market. And I was young, college kid. All I was drinking were domestic lagers and pilsners anyway. But our tastes, I think, evolved along with the craft beer market.
Yeah, I think there's
millennials of craft beers just been a part of their experience right from the get-go.
Exactly.
Well, they had Four Loko. Like, there have been down times.
But is Four Loko crafted locally with care?
It made my college a little famous.
No, but I agree. Like, there's something I think that we can harken back to with pride in kind of growing up with the craft industry and seeing it evolve and trying to kind of sort out what was authentic along the way. And I don't think that perhaps millennials care quite as much just because it's always been around us in the last 10 or so years in their coming of age. I feel like why should they? You know, it's good beer, and it may be owned by a macro brewery. It may not be. But, you know, this time around, I think macro breweries are doing it right by letting little guys keep on doing their stuff. I know, Jay, you had mentioned earlier, you know, you're shopping. You shop more by style now than brand. Is that accurate?
Yeah, and I've seen, we as packaging designers have seen.
Experts.
We as packaging experts have seen the pendulum swing from being more brand-based on some craft brewers to being more style-based and kind of back and forth as the craft beer drinkers' alliances or allegiances have evolved. So where I used to, you know, personally, I used to shop by brand. Oh, I like such and such a brewery. I'm going to try all their beers, to now being much more style-driven. Like, I love IPAs. I want to try all these different breweries' IPAs.
Yeah. I feel like there's some talk within the industry, from what I've read, about brewers being a little nervous about there being too much overwhelming choices for consumers right now. I personally am not overwhelmed. I love the variety, and I love seeing new flavors, new brews, new designs every time I come to the shelf. But I don't know, is that in their head? Is that in the industry's head? Or is it really something that consumers are being overwhelmed with today?
Well, I would say based on the way breweries are now designing their packages to be much different from style to style than be kind of a consistent branded look, that I think that's a trend that breweries have recognized, and as such are not trying to create a brand block on shelf, but really create a very distinct and unique personality for their beer styles, their different beer styles.
Mm-hmm. It's some of the more successful ones that I like are ones that have this maybe just a little visual breadcrumb in them of, you know, same logo placement every time or same architecture or layout every time, but then that kind of acts as a template for very cool and very very divergent artwork, so you can get that wide range. And maybe there's a nod to a core line that is more simpler, but I do love those brands out there.
Yeah, with all the proliferation of brands, you could get overwhelmed. I've kind of developed a shopping style for myself where I'll go to the IPA section and see whatever's on sale and then just try that. Like, oh, this one's $9 versus 13. I'll give it a shot.
$13 for a six pack is ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, I know. Tell me about it. That's why I use the what's on sale shopping technique.
Yes.
We haven't even talked about that. Like, are millennials interested in, like, I like to save a buck. Do millennials like to save a buck? I assume so.
You know, we're all human, and yes, I use that filter as well. You know, there may be the coolest kind of holographic design on a package, but I'm not going to pay $13 or $14 for that. I'm going to wait for it to come on sale. So today we're talking to Trent Tokos, who knows a lot about beer. He has been a client of ours in the past. He's been working at Craft Brew Alliance for the last 16 years in Portland, Oregon, 10 years marketing the Kona and Widmer brand, and he actually got his start at Anheuser-Busch. Trent, thanks for being here.
Oh, yeah, no problem.
We've been talking here about how big beer has had a few fits and starts in terms of trying to compete with craft, you know, first off trying to kind of create their own craft brews in-house, and then more recently, you know, the big brewers buying up some of the standout craft brands that are out there right now,
quietly buying them up.
I mean, is that a Is that a trend that that you see continuing?
I think if you talk to any big brewer 3 years ago, they would have said, you know, craft beer was one of the top things on their mind. And each of the big guys have done it in a little bit different way. I mean, they've all acquired to an extent, flash 3 years forward to today. And, you know, craft beer is still growing, but much slower than it was 3 years ago. I think if you have a brand with some authenticity like Legion or 10 Barrel, and you kind of leave them alone to do their thing, even though they're 100% owned, you utilize then Anheuser-Busch's ability to get distribution and things like that. And it seems to work. Like, you know, I think the best example is Space Dust is, you know, risen from basically a Seattle brand a few years ago to now one of the largest IPAs in the country on, you know, Anheuser-Busch's distribution strength alone. You know, I think what's on the big brewer's mind right now, which is a whole new phenomenon, is the whole hard seltzer thing. And you're sort of seeing them all scramble to figure out how, you know, they get a piece of that pie. I read something recently, I think, White Claw alone was bigger, I think, over the 4th of July than the entire craft beer category.
Has CBA's brand started to dip their toe into any of that experimentation?
We actually have an arm of our company. It's called the pH Experiment, which basically, you know, explores white space, you know, throughout the alcohol beverage category. And so we just launched last month a 2%, so a low ABV seltzer called Pacer. And then we're also doing some different, you know, we did like a version, a hazy IPA with Tang, that we sold through Amazon Prime stores. And so, like, we do have an arm of that it's pretty small, but sort of, you know, an incubator for new ideas within the space.
Do you guys see that as being a big part of your portfolio in the future?
It does seem like that category is here to stay. I mean, it's been here before with things like, you know, Zima and even like almost like your wine coolers and stuff. I am curious to see, you know, how much is the infatuation with White Claw and how that's just blown up on social media and everything else, and how much is actually an infatuation with the category. So, you know, you got, you know, I heard the other day a Bud Light seltzer coming, you know, Natural Light seltzers just launched. So it'll be interesting to see now that everybody's in that space, you know, what happens.
I wonder if there's a difference generationally, like,
which is kind of the core of our whole
millennial
question.
Males are probably, you know, drinking seltzer perhaps at a higher rate than Gen Xers like all of us.
Yeah, are you finding anything like that on your end in terms of metrics of the different generations? You know, is there anything to prove the millennials are, you know, indeed kind of eroding craft beer and moving into these other craft experiences?
You know, the whole millennial, like the idea of the adventurous, you know, they're always kind of moving on to the next thing. And, you know, I think that's what helped really, you know, drive the craft beer thing almost to a point where it got it became too much. I mean, the variety just got a little bit out of control. What's funny to look at is the hottest brand in beer is Modelo Especial, which, you know, is about as, you know, drinkable of a beer as you can have out there, and it's about as simple of a message. So it almost kind of took everybody and confused them further, even seltzer. I mean, it's, you know, as simple of a liquid as you could possibly get to. And I do think it is driven, you know, by millennials from a brand standpoint, especially with the White Claw phenomena, where now you can have something catch, you know, in social media and just sort of take on a life of its own.
Right. It makes sense. I mean, every generation has been looking for something that's accessible, you know, low alcohol, sessionable. And, you know, I suppose this is one way of how light beer has been, you know, the advent of light beer came upon us, and now this is kind of like that newest rendition of that.
It's interesting to see on the craft side too, where, you know, you used to have like a lot of pale ales and amber ales and all these sort of in between styles and craft that have really seemed to disappear. And those three or four taps are now IPAs.
Right.
So that's definitely been a shift in craft.
Well, it seems like, speaking of IPA, it seems like they've are getting more and more drinkable than IPAs were, you know, when you could find them 5 or 10 years ago.
It was like, more of a range.
Yeah, I've sampled some really high alcohol content double IPAs that are surprisingly drinkable.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely true. And the naming of beer styles right now is somewhat interesting, I guess you'd say, because, you know, I'm not sure that style went away, because now we just call it a session IPA. It's just sort of the way it's been categorized has changed a little bit.
We've noticed a lot of kind of rosé infused beers or ciders or seltzers. Is that an attempt to bring new people into the market?
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what that's for. I mean, we have on the Square Mile cider side, we have a rosé that's, you know, pretty quickly become our flagship on that brand. And beer, well, I would say the biggest issue for beer is spirits. I mean, spirits are what's really hot right now. If you think of everything from Tito's to, you know, now tequila's hot, and they're saying gin's the next big thing, and, you know, bourbon's been hot for a while. So you're seeing canned cocktails now too come out from, like, 10 Barrel just came out with them. So you see some breweries kind of diversifying that way. So I think you're definitely trying to see, like, breweries, whether it's through cider or now seltzer, or even to your point, beer that tastes like rosé, sort of blur those lines.
Yeah. We were talking about brand loyalty earlier. Have you seen shifts over the past, you know, your past couple decades in the craft industry about whether people are more loyal to a particular brewery or versus a particular style?
If we're talking about millennials or younger consumer, you know, they want kind of different, new, unique. So then, you know, you have a brand that might look completely different than ESB, but still be from Red Hook, because what we've found is the younger consumer says, I don't want Red Hook, that's just ESB. So in order to get them to try, say, our El Cenito Mexican Lager, or, you know, whatever it might be, our best chance is sort of to create a whole new look and feel, you know, and then they say, oh, what's that? I'll try that. And then realizing maybe later that it's even from Red Hook. Like, I think everyone's flagship, like, you know, every brewery is usually known for one beer. And I think whatever that flagship is, you're going to have loyal consumers to. But I think the rest of the portfolio is sort of, you know, somebody walks into the store and, you know, maybe it's price, you know, maybe it's, you know, time of year, and they want to try something a little bit different.
You know, I find myself being loyal to the region. You made me realize something about myself that perhaps I hadn't. And that was that when I'm traveling, I kind of want to try the local beer.
You know, that's why for us, you know, we really only sell Widmer and Red Hook in the Northwest now. Those brands were national and used to do really well all the way across the country. But that was also when, to your point, you know, there were no craft breweries in Florida, even like probably 10 years ago, 15 years ago for sure. And now there's, you know, 100 plus.
Right. Well, I can remember 15 years ago, the kind of emerging craft beer drinker would really reject anything that had anything to do with one of the big beers. Are you finding that millennials are more willing to kind of look past that just because they like the beer and aren't perhaps as quick to reject a smaller brewery that had been bought by a big beer as previous generations?
First of all, I think the big companies have gotten smarter. Right. You leave them alone and you let them do their thing, and and still sort of have that autonomy and sort of, you know, all the characteristics of kind of what made them great before they were bought. I do think that is an interesting thing, and I don't know if it's a millennial thing or not. You know, Jay, we did a bunch of studies on Blue Moon about 10 years ago. We found that 95% of the people surveyed didn't know it was from Miller Coors, and thought it was its own brewery and a crafty thing and all these things. But what was interesting was, and part of this might be they don't want to admit they've sort of been duped, because once they knew that it was from Miller Coors, it didn't change their perception. I mean, I think part of it, honestly, is that craft beer is so much more mainstream than it was then. So you still have the 1% of beer enthusiasts that really get pissed off when 10 Barrel gets bought by Anheuser-Busch. But then you have all these people that are drinking, you know, everything from Modelo to White Claw to Coors Light that also drink 10 Barrel that could really, you know, give two craps who it was owned by. We would have never 15 years ago thought about putting Widmer in a can. There was no way, because right, the perception was big domestic beer is in a can, good beer is in a bottle. Like, you know, import craft is in a bottle, you know, and which was actually like the wrong thinking, right? Because when you look at beer and what affects beer, the biggest thing to make beer deteriorate is sunlight. And so having beer in a can is actually much better for it long term than in a bottle. So some of those things have just been totally shattered by the younger consumer that says, what do you mean? Like, I like to drink when I camp. I like to drink when I'm outside, do all these things, put it in the can. And oh yeah, it's better for the environment and recycling and all these things, you know. And now, next thing you know, I mean, pretty soon you'll see very little bottles in craft beer.
Trent, when you buy beer now, when you walk the grocery store and you walk that aisle, what's going through your mind when you see all these new cans coming out?
I mean, it's overwhelming, and I'm in the industry. I mean, we'll go to Fred Meyer here in town, and I'll probably on any given time be able to point out two or three breweries that I've never even heard of, and I'm in the beer business.
One last thing with competition and the proliferation of breweries now, is there still room for brewing beers that you know aren't going to be big sellers, but you still want to brew them for the soul of the brand?
It's challenging. You know, one of our biggest challenges, you know, at the Portland Brewery, at the Widmer Brothers Brewery, is, you know, the smallest batch you can do is 500 kegs. Like, that's bigger than some breweries, you know. I mean, that's a decent amount of beer. So, you know, if, you know, you're probably only going to, on that brew kettle and that main brewery, you're only going to do a beer that you know that is going to sell in Safeway and Fred Meyer and all over, you know, whether it be chains or larger on-premise accounts. So it becomes more and more of a challenge. That's why we opened that brew lab up in Capitol Hill. That's a 10 barrel system. You know, so it's doing 20 kegs at a time, so we can do a lot of unique things, get it out into the market. You know, we're even sometimes packaging some of that and putting it, you know, whether it be at Amazon or somewhere else, to see what kind of, you know, quick consumer response we have. And if something catches, you know, we'd scale it up, kind of a thing. So it's definitely more difficult to do that, but it's still, to your point, I mean, it's part of the brand. This year, for the first time, we're going to do a run of Snowplow.
Oh, I was hoping that's what you were going to say.
Yeah, so we're going to do 6-pack cans and draft. We're going to brew it once, and it's going to yield like 6,000 cases. And when it's gone, it's gone.
Oh, you know, I'll be stocking up.
And it's, you know, people are excited about it. It'll be at, you know, Total Wine and More. It'll be at, you know, New Seasons and some of these other places. And, you know, and it's part of our history. It's a great beer. It's got a great story.
Thank you for your time here and help.
Yes, thanks.
Oh, yeah, no problem.
Clearly, we love beer, and we've got a lot of takeaways about it, too.
One of the biggest things I took away with our audit and our taste test was this trend towards more drinkable versions of beers, like IPAs with the rosé IPAs, and just a general kind of trend towards more refreshing, in air quotes, beers or drinks, you know, because certainly if you could think about the appeal of a White Claw or something as far as refreshing versus like a heavy porter or something like that.
I wish I could say I had a rosé IPA in 1996 to help me transition into drinking IPA for the first time. So there are those nice kind of stepping stones to get people, I think, to kind of experiment a little bit and get adventurous with beer.
Adventurous is a cool word because I think it could go either way. Like Jay drinks these ciders, and I wouldn't have pegged you as a cider guy 2 weeks ago, but I mean, I really think of you as a cider guy now. It goes both ways, I think. Like IPAs can lead you into interesting flavors that then gets you into rosés, and then seltzers and hard ciders can move you into rosé-infused IPAs that can move you into like heavier, hoppier, more delicious beers. So it works both ways, and I think that's probably the ultimate takeaway from me is it's all about adventure.
Adventure, I think this generation is demanding more options, more adventurous options than perhaps we did when we were in our formative beer drinking years, just as evidenced by the just sheer volume of different styles of beer, different, and even outside of beer with the ciders and the seltzers that, you know, I'd never heard of a hard cider or a hard seltzer 20 years ago or 10 years ago even.
Right.
I think there's more
permission for, dare I say it, guys to drink things outside of beer than there were a few years or generations ago. You know, I think beer could fairly be called a manly drink of sure. the drinks out there. Not to say that plenty of women also drink beer as well, but now there's a lot of range in beer in terms of strong versus new and adventurous flavors. And there's also, I think, just more expectation for both men and women to kind of drink around the spectrum of beer to seltzer to hard cider. You know, this article on White Claw that I was reading was quoting a consumer, a male, saying that when the drink first emerged on the scene this summer, even as early as this summer, guys were drinking them in secret, quote unquote. There's no shame in drinking White Claw now. They're fairly irresistible, he said. They don't make you feel bloated, and they taste good, and they get you pretty wasted.
I love feeling bloated.
And I feel like that goes back to one of the tenets about, you know, beer in the last century or half century at least, is people have been drinking light beer for years just so that they can drink a lot of them and not feel filled up, and they can kind of just down them without really thinking throughout the day. It's sessionable. And so these are other beverages now that are sessionable and delicious as well.
Well, I would say to big beer, keep doing what you're doing in terms of buying up craft breweries and then not messing them up and let them do their thing and bring all the good things that you can bring, like consistency and volume, but don't try to, you know, tear the soul of the craft brewery away or make it something or mold it in your own image.
And if you are a craft brewery, like make sure you have a soul that can't be stripped away. Like make it undeniable that you
part
have
of
a,
your
you have
brand.
A, yeah, you have a place in this world and an important point of view on beer.
Employ a minister of culture, so to speak. Small craft breweries should be hosting events that pertain to their brand, you know, whether it's like a film festival or skateboarding event or what have you, something that relates back to their locale or heritage. They're the ones that need to be cultivators of their own culture and not let that escape. The big brewers, the big breweries should just encourage that if they know what's good for them.
As brand experts, we have a lot of thoughts around how to make an impact at shelf, be relevant, be distinct.
So are millennials killing big beer?
I don't think they are. I think they're making beer better. I think they're forcing beer to be better. And I think Gen Xers and other generations, even my dad's generation, are now kind of up to speed on what a good beer tastes like and are demanding in a kind of intergenerational way for better, more innovative products.
Maybe a better question is, are they killing big brands? Because clearly they're not killing big beer, because big beer has just evolved into buying craft beers and or seltzer companies or cider companies and turning right around, and they're being bought up by millennials and Gen Xers alike. But are they killing big brands?
Like, the big pilsner.
At least on the coasts, I would probably say yes.
I still find Coors in
millennial
ice chests.
I see a lot of Rainier here locally. You get the local, that local aspect of, I'm drinking a local beer here, even though it's this light pilsner.
I feel like the light beers are actually kind of an ironic choice a lot of the time now, too. The Pabst Blue Ribbon, the Rainiers.
Rainier just came out with a light called Rainier Summit. It's almost retro.
I think that was with the rise of PBR was there was a desire for a light pilsner or lager, but also a desire not to be drinking Bud Light or Coors Light or Miller. So PBR was the kind of outlier, the kind of rebel version of a light beer.
Wasn't it in Blue Velvet too? Wasn't it Dennis Hopper's favorite beer? I can't remember.
Was it?
I remember it was my dad's favorite beer.
There's a lot of cult tie-ins, I feel, to PBR. Over the next 5 years, the global low alcohol market is set to double, reaching $25 billion by 2024. And the global beer market is at $114 billion this year. So basically a quarter of that is expected to become or be low alcohol or no alcohol in the next 5 years.
What are they going to be doing? Just smoking weed?
What will be the news tagline? Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. What will be that?
Vape, bud, and...
Do it for the gram.
That's right.
Bad dad jokes.
Well, that makes me feel better as a parent of two Gen Zers.
Me too.
I feel like their beverage choices have been curtailed by us. I drank a lot of soda growing up, for example, and now my kids are growing up on LaCroix and stuff like that that's very understated and, of course, no sugar. I don't know if sugar can be equated to alcohol content, but, you know, what is the equivalent drink for them?
Might the future of beer, may the pendulum swing back where people just are over all of the, you know, their heads spinning in the beer aisle with all these choices and give me some good beers and that don't have guava and mango in them and let me enjoy.
Right. Will the beer aisle 20 years from now look like your grandfather's beer aisle with about five choices of watered down beer? Who knows? Will people's palates rebel? I don't know.
Will there be a new Carry Nation with an axe?
What's the axe of the 21st century?
Laser.
Choo choo. Just blasting bars.
Blast that beer out of your hand. Thank you for listening to
the
Death
Bad
by
Dad's
Millennial
Takeover.
Bad Dad's Takeover Beer Edition.
I hope we're invited back.
We had a lot of fun drinking beer
at work.
This podcast is produced by Hornell Anderson. Artwork by Damian Bertels. Sound design and editing by Katie Schultz, with marketing support from Amber Johnson, Britt Stromberg, Stephanie Downs, Claudia Cicero, Jacob Toby, and Tim Garrison.